This Institute of Ideas podcast is called New Wars, New Technology. It was recorded at the Battle of Ideas 2015 at the Barbican in London.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you. Congratulations on making it on this Sunday morning to this debate. New Wars, New Technology, the first debate in the strand War and Peace. My name's Rob Lyons. I'm Science and Technology Director at the Institute of Ideas. The deaths of the Médecins Sans Frontières staff by a US drone in northern Afghanistan earlier this month brought the discussion about the wisdom of using drones back to center stage. While promoted as a means of delivering a precise surgical strike without risking the lives of service personnel from the West, many are uncomfortable about the way in which they seem to turn war from a genuine fight into something akin to a video game. And there are also questions to be asked about whether they really are as surgical and precise as their proponents claim them to be. But it's not just drones that are changing the nature of war today. ISIS has proven to be a stubborn enemy with an ability to attract wannabe jihadis from across the West thanks to its use of social media. North Korea's alleged cyber attack on Sony was a reminder that of the damage that can be done without a shot being fired. But old-fashioned warfare still has a place as well. The Syrian civil war is being conducted using fairly crude technology when compared to drones, and that's certainly the case with Boko Haram's insurgency in West Africa. So how much has war really changed today? How much might technology influence things in the future? Will war in the future be conducted from behind a desk, or do we still need boots on the ground? And will those boots be worn by robots in the future? So I'll introduce the speakers in the order they're going to speak. On my immediate right is Christopher Coker. He's Professor of International Relations at the LSE. His books include Future War, Can War Be Eliminated? And Warrior Geeks, How 21st Century Technology is Changing the Way We Fight and Think About War. On my far left is Chris Woods. He's a London-based investigative reporter and a former senior producer with Newsnight and Panorama. He's director of airwars.org, which monitors international coalition strikes against Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, and is author of Sudden Justice, America's Secret Drone Wars. Then to my near left is Justin Bronk. He's a research analyst specializing in air power and technology in the military sciences team at RUSI, and he's also assistant editor of the RUSI Defense Systems Online Journal. And finally, on my far right is James Woodhausen. He's visiting professor of forecasting and innovation at London South Bank University. He first wrote about chemical and biological weapons for The Economist back in 1978 and has been a keen observer of the changing face of war ever since. He's worked for a long list of tech firms over the years, and he's a frequent contributor to Radio 4 and to Spiked, the online magazine. So the panel will introduce their thoughts for about 7 minutes each, and then we'll start a discussion, and you can make your own questions and comments. It's not a Q&A, it's a proper debate. We're very much interested in your point of view first as well. So, first, Christopher Coker.
Thank you very much. I think it's very commendable that you've all turned up this morning at this particular time on a Sunday. You may know the famous line from Henry V, Shakespeare's play, "Gentlemen abed today will hold their manhoods cheap. They were not here on Crispin's Day." So you're here on Crispin's Day, and your manhoods and womanhoods are obviously not cheap in your mind. I've only got now 6.5 minutes as the clock is ticking, so I have to make one or two general points. Point one is that we're at a point, I think, in war where warriors themselves, it's the people who actually fight wars, are very conflicted. There was a big debate a year or so ago in the United States about the Distinguished Service Medal, which in the eyes of many of the American military is more important than the Purple Heart or the Bronze Star. The Pentagon had intended to award this medal to drone pilots, and there was outcry and outrage amongst American veterans, particularly special forces, who feel that because they're in the front line and actually in the field rather than 7,000 miles away in Nevada, they had more right to this medal than any others. It's still an unresolved debate, but we do have new warriors coming out there. Cubicle warriors is what drone pilots are often called. Cyber warriors are the people who spend their time behind screens, not even watching or seeing what damage perhaps they are inflicting, just having to use their imagination to imagine it. The warrior is the oldest stereotype, the oldest trope, if you like, in war. It's been there for a long time. We listen to the same radio station, but we listen to different frequencies. So here's another warrior, another stereotype. The American Special Forces captured an Al-Qaeda camp in 2004 and found that there was a manual for Al-Qaeda operatives. And one of the annexes said what to do in the event that you were taken prisoner. You could still be a warrior by banging your head against the wall, pretending that this had been done to you by your captives, and showing your wounds to the International Red Cross should they come along. Of course, the manual said it's better still to get the Americans to actually torture you, but that's going to be difficult because they don't like doing this, and they don't like doing this because, and this is the point of the story, they are not warriors. So here we have a fascinating world in which the idea of the warrior is still there in the imagination of both the West and those enemies that the West has identified. And yet we are really conflicted about whether there is any scope left for the so-called warrior virtues, or whether everyone is just now becoming a technician or a technocrat. The second point of this story is that war evolves. It always finds new evolutionary niches, and the two niches that are rapidly being found are cyberspace and outer space, and I hope that we will touch upon that, because it's in outer space that a war between the United States and China is likely to pan out in 10 or 15 years' time, as well as cyberspace. When I say war evolves, I'm using it figuratively in the way that Matt Ridley does in his most recent book, that evolution is actually the theory of everything. Figuratively, not literally, but it's powered by cultural diffusion as well. Once you invent something, everybody else wants it. There are 76 countries in the world today that have or are planning to get drone technology. The 15 largest economies in the world today have cyber warfare capabilities, or at least are planning to be able to defend themselves against cyber attacks. My belief is that war is only going to end in two circumstances. Once, to cite the Second World War poet Sidney Keyes, who said that the world is at war because it's not yet ready for peace. I think that is a profound observation. I don't think we are ready for peace. But the second reason is that war will only end when it's exhausted its evolutionary potential or its evolutionary capability. At that point, we may be out of the war business. The third point is, what is changing? What's changing is that we are now talking for the first time in a very long time about the possibility of great power conflict. If I talked about the possibility of another great power conflict 5 years ago, I think very few people would have bothered to wait for the discussion. Now, it's a serious topic of conversation in the lecture circuits across the world. Whether it's great power conflict between the United States and China, and both countries are gaming like mad for it. A new book has just come out by Peter Singer called Ghost Fleet, which is based on 50 pages of footnoted open source material and some redacted material, which will explain exactly how those two countries plan to fight a war with each other, or perhaps more immediately whether there's likely to be a conflict between Russia and the West ourselves, and in what area it's likely to take place. Because, you see, this is the bad news. We all thought that nuclear weapons would make great power conflict impossible, but now we know that there are ways in which you can fight, or we think there are ways in which we can fight another great power without it going nuclear, at least in the early days. In Peter Singer's case, the war lasts 55 days between the US and China before they suddenly realize that they're very near the nuclear threshold and have to stop. My third and final point is that war is, on the one hand, getting bigger in terms of high tech, which we'll be discussing today, but it's also getting smaller in terms of low tech. And my bottom line is that drone technology that we associate with the big powers, particularly the United States, is going to be superseded quite soon by drone technology, by terrorists, and by others. The drone is actually the best weapon system that's ever been invented for terrorist attacks. You can buy a drone off the shelf now for as little as $400. You can make a 3D printed drone for as little as $9. Indeed, the price of drones, 3D printed drones, will be almost zero. You can make technically 100 drones a day, 3D printed, in your own garage if you wish to do this. This is why war is going to get incredibly smaller. And then there's crowdsourcing. In the Ukraine, there is a group that makes 40 drones a month thanks to crowdsourcing. $300 have been raised to actually buy your own drones. You can form a syndicate and do that. They're the first that I know syndicate in the world that's done this. Other syndicates will do the same. So it raises the question whether the ownership of war is moving into other hands from states to non-state actors. But I'm going to end with a story. It's a story about David and Goliath, and it's the one that Malcolm Gladwell tells in his most recent book. We all know the biblical story, do we not, of young David facing the 7-foot-tall, heavily armored Goliath, and David surprisingly gets to win. But as Gladwell says in his book, actually it's no surprise David won. First point, Goliath was obviously suffering from giganticism, one of the problems of which is that you don't have peripheral vision. So if you have a little shepherd boy dancing around you, because indeed he does dance, poor old Goliath couldn't see David most of the time. The second is that David had the sling, which was the most effective weapon ever devised in the ancient world, and if used effectively could penetrate Bronze Age armor as no other weapon really could. So actually David, with his low tech, the sling, was actually better off than Goliath with his high tech, his armor. But here's my last point. This is not what David would have said had he gone back to the Israelite camp that night and been debriefed so that we could do lessons learned. He would have said, the reason I won today is that God was on my side and he wasn't on the side of Goliath. That's ultimately the world that we're entering. God for us is high tech and technology. God for our enemies is the old-fashioned God. And I wonder which is less delusional, belief in high tech or belief in the Almighty being there, rooting you, rooting for you as you fight. And on that note, I shall end.
Thank you very much. Chris.
Thank you very much, everyone, for coming along. I'm going to be talking really about drones, specifically this morning, remotely piloted aircraft systems, as the British insist on calling them, drones, as everyone else calls them, and about how really there's a narrative that's built up around the use of armed drones on the battlefield, that somehow they are deliverers of perfection for those who are using them. For the British, the Americans, the Israelis, these are the only nations that have so far fielded armed drones on the battlefield. That our drones don't kill anyone but bad guys. And in my view, drones risk becoming enablers of military and political fantasy. Those who are actually committing us to engagements, to military engagements, to wars, putting us, the UK, and other countries in conflict situations, are leading us there by a particular false narrative. I do think that drones have revolutionized war. I don't think it's in the way that it's usually characterized. It's usually suggested that the drones themselves are the technological revolution. Actually, the drones are terribly primitive platforms. They are, when you talk to ARPA's designers, they talk about the iteration of drones we've got right now as being very similar to the Wright brothers' early airframes. These are very, very primitive aircraft with some very high-tech kit on them. The revolution of the drone, in my view, is the intelligence that lies behind the drone. Dozens, sometimes hundreds of human beings, not machines, who are poring over intelligence in real time and analyzing and understanding what's being seen on the battlefield. We didn't have that before. What we used to have up until the mid-1990s was satellite passes, U-2 reconnaissance, overflights, photographs, physical photographs would be gathered, they'd be taken back, they'd be analyzed weeks, sometimes months later. That's how we used to do it. How we do it now is real-time analysis, and that's the revolution that armed drones and other what's called ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance assets give us on the battlefield. But there's another issue with that, and it puts politicians in the cockpit of the drones in a way we've never had before. Politicians used to have to wait for the analysis like everybody else. Now we have a situation where everybody can see the information that's coming in, and that's becoming a problem. Now, I talked about the weapon systems themselves, and there is a drive in Western military technology around precision. This is a really important aspect of Western warfare. It's a pursuit we've followed really since the 60s and 70s. Aerial warfare historically has been very indiscriminate. It's been an instrument of mass casualties. Over time, the West has focused more and more on precision weapons, becoming more and more precise, getting your weapons to the point they're intended to go. And that discussion around relative precision is a really important one, a really valuable one. And I think we can distinguish, for example, in the casualties that the West is inflicting in Syria right now versus Russia, we can characterize that by the precision versus non-precision weapons being used. But here's the danger with drones, and this is why they have become a problem. In the last 4 or 5 years, and this is a very recent development, we've switched from a discussion of relative precision to a fantasy discussion of absolute precision. So in 2010, 2011, we had the CIA start to claim that it doesn't kill civilians anymore in its drone strikes in Pakistan. That same year, NATO, in its airstrikes in Libya, got to the end of the campaign and announced publicly, we didn't kill any civilians. And then right now in Iraq and Syria, we've had, I think, 7,500 airstrikes, 25,000 bombs and missiles dropped on Iraq and Syria, and our militaries and our governments are telling us we're not killing civilians. Well, this is what we journalists call a lie. It's not true. You go back and you look at the CIA. The CIA killed dozens of civilians in the time window that they claimed. For Libya, when NATO said it hadn't killed any civilians, there were 5 independent investigations, including by the UN, that concluded that at least 80 civilians had died. Not a large number, but an important number. And then in Iraq and Syria today, we have a situation where, as I say, 7,500 airstrikes, the latest estimate from the Pentagon is that we've killed 20,000 enemy fighters, 20,000 Daesh fighters in the last 14 months. The coalition has admitted to 2 civilian deaths in Syria and none in Iraq. That's, of course, not true. And the group I run, Air Wars, we're presently estimating that we think the coalition has killed around 600 civilians, probably more. And sometimes stories puncture that narrative. Sometimes stories break through. As I say, not a single civilian death admitted to in Iraq. But there was a case at the end of September where the coalition bombed a reported Islamic State weapons dump. And unfortunately, the secondary explosions destroyed a number of local houses and killed a very ordinary middle-class family, university professor, his son, his niece, and his sister-in-law. We would never really have got traction on that story if they hadn't been family members of a Yale professor who then posted an article in the New York Times and said, we have killed my family. So the issue around armed drones, the issue around this fantasy around precision and absolute precision is that it leads our politicians and our militaries into committing us to wars which we as general publics think are safe. We think we're only killing the bad guys. Well, it's not true. It's not true, and we need to fundamentally question why we're being spun those stories and whether what we're being told is new technologies, new wars, is actually the old wars just dressed up in new clothing. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
So this is a slightly illustrious company to be in, but I'll give it my best. I'm going to start out just with a word on UCAVs as opposed to ARPAs, which are unmanned combat aerial vehicles. This is what I would view as the next big ethical dilemma facing the modern Western military, and very soon after that, the Chinese military, which is based around the problem that, as Chris said, drones as we think of them now that we use to kill Daesh fighters, CIA targets, whatever it might be, are remotely piloted. That is, you have 2 blokes looking at the monitors, seeing what the drone sees, and with a whole slew of people behind them, including lawyers, imagery analysis. You know, essentially the pilot with a couple of seconds delay, but with focused sensors to look. The problem with that is it all goes through a satellite data link. It has to. Satellite data links are vulnerable. They're very, very obvious and detectable in the electromagnetic spectrum. So when you see things like a top secret, extremely stealthy, called an RQ-170 American spy drone, landing undamaged without its self-destruct mechanism going off in Iran, and then the Iranians building their own plywood mock-ups and saying, we've got stealth technology. One has to ask how easy it is for even a near-peer competitor to take over, hijack, or at the very least disrupt those satellite links. When you're talking about drones for replacing human beings in very high-risk state-on-state warfare, which is where particularly the U.S. Navy is pushing forward with a program called X-47B, looks like something Batman would produce, and it flies itself. It does not have a pilot doing the control inputs. It's told what to do in terms of a mission, but it takes off, flies the mission, plans it, lands itself. Now, that is much more what the public think of as drones. But the issue around it is when it comes down to weapons release. Now, weapons release occurs at the highest threat point of most flights. So when a B-2 stealth bomber comes in, the highest threat picture when it's right above the defenses of what it's targeting, it has to open its bomb bay doors, and that actually produces a massive spike in the threat graph in terms of mission planning, is just when the bomb doors open, because the radar cross-section goes up. Now, if you're saying that a highly stealthy, normally autonomous system has to, at that moment, not only open its weapon bay, but broadcast up to a satellite to get a simple yes or no from a human being, it's just not feasible. So how far back are you going to push that authorization for weapons release and target selection? The military logic, if left to the West, might suggest, well, do we need this? It's a bit too ethically difficult. I don't think China is going to give us that option, because the Chinese have no scruples about that sort of thing. Yeah. If they can do it with a drone, great. Are we going to stay behind because it's ethically inconvenient? The history of technology and warfare suggests no. Moving on slightly to less related topic, but again on technological developments in warfare. Two rather cool sci-fi weapon systems coming up. Again, US Navy really pushing them, US Air Force as well. Both relying on large amounts of electricity to reduce cost per shot. Lasers and railguns. Railgun is actually essentially a conventional idea done in an unconventional way. It's propelling an extremely simple metal slug at very, very high velocities, up to about Mach 10. The idea being that it's impossible to shoot down, and the kinetic energy alone is very powerful. That, not particularly ethically different from anything else that we've been doing. Lasers, on the other hand, for defensive or close-in purposes, they don't work past range. Obviously, they're limited by line of sight. You can't shoot through a hill. But are we comfortable, for example, with shooting people with lasers? Now, there's no reason in sort of logically speaking that it should be any more inhumane than shooting someone with a bullet. But actually, I think instinctively, people are, for example, very uncomfortable with the idea of blinding enemy soldiers deliberately. I mean, why? You're still leaving them alive. But actually, there's been the technology to blind, for example, pilots on attack jets. We used it in the Falklands, actually, quite quietly for a long time. It's generally not deployed for ethical reasons. I'm not sure that debate's going to stay away, given that laser technology is getting to a point where it can be mounted in relatively compact installations. The Israelis now put it under airliners, for example, when there's a high threat of man-portable missile system launch. So, again, the technology has reached a point where I'm not sure most militaries around the world outside the West are going to hold back from deploying it, so we're maybe not going to be left with much choice on it. And thirdly, just trying to range around a bit, given the debates around Trident, which Mr. Corbyn has weighed into recently, and the return of great power threat from Russia and potentially China too, I think an interesting question just to throw out to try and get some people arguing is that I would question the entire validity of a nuclear-free world as a goal, because given you can't eliminate the knowledge of how to build a nuclear weapon, the principle is very, very well known. It's been shown several times, in fact, that university-level, undergrad-level physics students left in a room for a week as an experiment with no contact to the outside world can come up with a valid, workable design. Therefore, even were you to come up with an international agreement dismantle every nuclear weapon, every enrichment facility, kill every nuclear scientist, destroy every factory capable of making a bolt that is suitable for use in making a nuclear weapon. You could probably only push back the reconstruction timescale to about 3 to 4 years for an advanced superpower. Now, at that point, assume there is any kind of international crisis. It's not just what is the benefit of being the first one to rearm. It's what is the cost for being the second. And you can make a nuclear deterrent survivable. That's the whole basis of nuclear deterrence. You can't take out your opponent's nuclear capability. You can't make a regeneration capability survivable because it's factories, universities, scientists. And those tend to be in populated areas. So you actually then create a necessity to strike at your opponent's regeneration efforts because you can't be the second one to get your bomb back. Then assuming that two powers are both, you know, fighting while trying to regenerate, say you're the first one to get your bomb back. You only have one. They're pretty expensive. You don't have much uranium. Do you demonstrate it in the open ocean? What if it doesn't work? And again, remember that your opponent may be only a couple of days, weeks, months behind you. Well, you're probably going to have to use it against their regeneration capability because, again, you can't risk it. And remember that it's not enough to just say you have it because both sides will say they have it before they do. So I would just suggest that actually the goal of a nuclear-free world would actually be a deeply destabilizing and extremely dangerous and irresponsible thing to pursue. That's not to say we shouldn't reduce the number of nuclear weapons. We should. But in fact, I'd argue the British nuclear weapons program is the model by which all others should attempt. Well, we should be proud of it and try and show it as an example for others to follow. It's the minimum warheads to make it feasible. It's on the safest, most survivable system, and it's astonishingly cheap for what it provides. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Plenty of food for debate from that. James.
Well, thank you, Chris. I do want to say that technology is always changing, and the technologies of war are changing a fair bit. And I'd be very happy to discuss robotics, as I just read a paper by Gil Pratt, who was in charge of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Program Agency in the United States, about the advances in robotics, which I feel I've been interested in for a long time. But having said that, let me ask the first of four questions. Is technology really changing war today? And I would say yes, but what's new? In the following and recently rather prominent areas, there are important technological developments, but few really qualitative breakthroughs. And I think it's very important to get the full panoply of the stuff we're up against. Space, air, naval, artillery and infantry, special forces, nuclear, cruise, CBW, chemical and biological, intelligence, energy as a weapon, which Jonathan's already hinted at in the discussion on lasers, and the railgun. Very interested to hear more about that. Hybrid warfare, as reputedly Putin is prosecuting in the Ukraine, and then land and sea drones. I think if you look at all of those fields, and by land drones I mean robots, among other things, you'll find that there is advance, but there's not really a major qualitative breakthrough. I think in two fields you could say that there is a bit of a breakthrough. First is cyber warfare, and the second is aerial drones. They're nautical drones, they're land drones, or they can go over terrain. But air drones or unmanned aerial vehicles, along with cyber warfare, are a bit of a qualitative breakthrough. And I agree with what Chris has said about the sort of software and human backup that goes beyond the little balsa wood 3D printed in your garage thing. So I want to say that there are some changes. If you look at one of the rubbish documents that Citibank and two Oxford scribblers, Carl Frey and Michael Osborne, say in a more general civilian context that the robots are taking over. They got a great table. Ground defense spending on ground or unmanned systems by the U.S. Department of Defense, 2018, $66 million. So not a lot is happening there. Maritime drones, $382 million. Of course, the figures that the Secret Services print in, or the Department of Defense prints, may not be the real figures. But that when you learn that there's $4.4 billion being spent on aerial drones, then I think we can say that on land and sea, robots are fairly weak. There is stuff happening in the air. But I don't believe that there's really, beyond the two fields I've mentioned, cyber and UAVs, there's really a qualitative breakthrough. Now, the second question I want to raise is technology dehumanizing war? And my answer, again, is yes, but what's new in show business? It's true that since the RAF used phosphorus against Iraq in 1926, use of remote weapons has been cowardly, and that they reduce war to little more than a chess or now a video game. And I think Chris and also the two Chrises, in fact, have written rather eloquently about the sort of remote distance and also the not just the remoteness, but that you won't necessarily, if you're in a cubicle and you are a cubicle warrior, as Christopher Coker has pointed out, you won't necessarily know the whole picture. So you're remote, not just in the physical sense, but you're much more depersonalized. So there is dehumanization in war today, there's no doubt about it. But then I don't believe, and this is where I part with Christopher Coker, I don't believe that war was always, while a human endeavor, so noble an endeavor as your heroes, the Greeks, so and Thucydides and everything make out. You know, I don't want to celebrate war if I can avoid it. This is the main point. In thinking about war, we need to be careful not to follow the civilian tendency to make technology the central driver of modern events. It isn't. That's deterministic. It's human beings that create the technology, and the technology is not yet, and probably never will be, autonomous from us. Different authors, including the panel here, recognize that, but they're so captured by, it seems this morning, especially aerial drone technology, they're not looking at all the other aspects that I know Jonathan does in his excellent PDF on the Eurofighter program, which I've trudged through it with great amusement and interest. You're not looking at the other weapon systems that are around. And the mistake that's more broadly made is that we make an error, not me, an old error of CND and liberal opponents of war, always to focus on the most egregious or illegal examples. Nuclear weapons in the past, nowadays drones, landmines, cluster bombs, and arms exports. People focus on the newer stuff or the most lethal stuff. They then argue that it isn't really precise, as Chris does, that we're being sold a pup, as the other Chris does. And that's all true, but it's wrong to fasten on any particular weapon system, or even all of them, as the driving tendency behind wars. And I think what Christopher Coker has said about great power conflict, which people in the Institute of Ideas have always been very I don't know if you can be keen on it or appreciative of it, but that's the driving thing. It's the social systems and the conflict between nation states, not the technology, that's the key thing. Is technology really the reason why the West can't fight ISIS? I'm interested to hear from Chris Woods that 20,000 al-Qaeda have died, including 600 civilians who weren't related. That seems an enormously high figure for the US effort, because basically it seems to me a bit like those five recruits they made at the cost of $5 billion or whatever it was. They ain't doing nothing down there. So I do not believe that technology is the reason that they're not beating ISIS. I think it's lack of resolve. I think it's morale. I think it's Obama being fudgy and fluffing it. And that's a social human question. Just to conclude, what's so great about technology anyway? It would certainly be foolish to overestimate what morale alone can do in the face of high technology. But as Christopher Coker suggested in sort of the Al-Qaeda war manual, technology counts for little without its human animators. And the whole discussion about boots on the ground shows that, in theory at least, there is little substitute in 2015 for what Rob reminded us of, the poor bloody infantry, or at least the threat of the poor bloody infantry. From Vietnam to Boko Haram, clear objectives, a cohesive ideology, even if it's consistent nihilism in the case of ISIS, have been more vital to military success than any particular weapon. All the Silicon Valley geeks that Obama can muster cannot help him win the battle for hearts and minds, both at home and abroad. So war remains a social, not a technological question. Let's not single out any particular nasty weapon and say we've got to hold our leaders for account. Let's oppose the Western intervention in the Middle East that has brought nothing but death and destruction there and no progress whatsoever.
Thank you. So there's a wide range of different things to think about through all this, from the technology itself. How does it work? Is it everything it's cracked up to be? How is it actually changing the nature of the conflicts themselves, and whether conflicts start or do not start because and also the ethics of using particular weapons. Should we, since, you know, as was mentioned earlier, you know, if we're, you know, should we be worried about blinding people when the alternative is killing them? There's some interesting ethical dilemmas going on there. So your thoughts, please, comments or questions on any of that. And if it's just a technical question, you want to find out more about a particular technology, please fire away as well. We've got one here.
My question wants to pick up where Christopher Coker started with Shakespeare and Crispin Day, and that national, effectively national mobilisation that Henry V has got. He's aware that he needs to mobilise the nation behind his war. He's concerned about the resolve of the army and sort of mutterings about the war. But as we know, you know, Henry the Fourth, he's got Falstaff, he's got the tavern behind him. He's a popular prince. But if we were to look at the question of great power conflict today, I think there is an issue for the West at the moment in terms of national mobilisation. There's a deep ambivalence about that. And if war is a continuation of politics in Clausewitzian terms, and if we've got the mobilisation of the great powers to war, isn't there a huge issue politically where the Chinese are potentially mobilised for war, Russia is potentially, as a nation, is potentially mobilised for war, but I'm not sure that the resolve in the West is similar. I'm not suggesting we mobilise for great power conflict, but I think there is an issue about the disengagement of populations in the West to the emerging wars.
Okay, just pass it forward to this guy here.
I was reading that the aircraft carrier is going to become obsolete because China is developing high-speed missiles. Then I hear about lasers, and lasers are going to shoot down high-speed missiles and everything. I don't know. Rather than, you know, the specific question there, but the general thing, I mean, to what extent do you think there'll actually be a change of technology, things will move? Or as James was saying, you know, we've heard this all before. At one stage, you'll have something, you'll put one nation ahead, then it'll move back. I mean, I know Ronald Reagan was going on about Star Wars. My initial reaction to Star Wars was it might be 99% effective, you might have 100 times overkill on nuclear weapons. Go figure.
Two quick points. Firstly, I think all this discussion about gamification of warfare by drones, do you know any medieval history? It seems awfully similar to the discussion of how archery was an unchivalrous weapon and the attempts by both professional tribal warriors, the knights, and also by the hippie peace activists in their monasteries with their Gregorian chant and their Peace of God movement to ban the crossbow. And we all know how that attitude to archery worked out for the French in the Hundred Years' War. The other one is one of those technical questions. If in 2030 the Chinese do want to level Taipei, do you think they'll send in a huge fleet of small stealthy drones, each carrying a small bomb, or will they just use an intermediate-range ballistic missile with a nuclear tip?
I'm just wondering, to get back to that original quote about peace, what is the budget that should be assigned to peace then, which seems to be something that we're not discussing.
Okay.
And I also had a technical question regarding the concept of the railgun. Because of the amount of kinetic energy required to propel metal rod that speed, is it more of a theory, or is it any form of it in practice?
Okay, so I'll go across the panel for now. Don't worry, I'll come back out to you. So I'll start with Chris. Just pick up on anything you wanted to answer. You don't have to answer anything by any means.
Yeah, fantastic questions, everyone. Thank you. I'm going to jump in on the drones, because it was also something that that James picked up on. I agree that there's a risk here of over fetishizing around the drones, but like it or not, that's where our militaries and our media and our politicians are focused at the moment. When the Prime Minister stood up a couple of weeks ago and said we're going to have 20 new protectors, and you know, there was a huge uproar in the press about this. People get very excited about it. The value, two things with drones. One is it's simply where the conversations about contemporary and future war are coalescing right now. So we just take advantage of that. But two, and I think more importantly, there is a narrative being built around the use of drones, specifically and air power more broadly, which in my view is dangerous at the moment. We keep going into these air-only wars. And your fantastic question, sir, about what's the budget for peace, I think is a brilliant question. When the UK engaged in Libya in 2011, the SNP got some figures out of the government a few weeks ago showing that we spent 14 times more bombing Libya back in 2011 than we have spent at all in reconstruction efforts since. We are very good at dismantling regimes right now. We are absolutely terrible at dealing with the chaos that is then unleashed by them. And the enabler for this behavior is air power, and drones are pretty central to that. So I agree that there's an over-fetishization of drones, but there's this driving narrative of air power delivers everything we need is what's pushing our politicians and militaries at the moment, and we need to pay attention, I think.
Okay, Justin.
Just on the, first of all, on the drone railgun question, the power levels that they're looking at the moment, around 15 megawatts, the US Navy currently has two prototype railgun systems deployed on a high-speed transport, i.e. an auxiliary vessel called HMS Ponce, weirdly enough, but anyway. One built by General Atomics, one built by BAE Systems. They can both propel about this big lump of streamlined tungsten to about Mach 7. So to put that in perspective, the amount of kinetic energy that will deliver just without any explosives, just from transmitting that kinetic energy into a target at the horizon is about twice as much as the armor-piercing sabot shells fired by main battle tanks at the muzzle. So it can they're pretty powerful, and the US Navy is looking to go up to about 50 megawatts. The problem with them is, at the moment, that the technology is fully understood to make it work. They've been test-fired many times. They work. The problem is that in order to make a railgun accelerate an object down the barrel, which is done, obviously, through electromagnets, the projectile itself completes the circuit between two rails. And the force is actually trying to repel the rails outwards because it's opposing magnetic forces. Hugely powerful. And the only way for that force to go is along the barrel, which is what generates the force. The problem is that we are not at a stage in material sciences yet where we can create a barrel and rails that can withstand the enormous push-out forces and the enormous heat generated by the friction of the rails going up for more than a couple of rounds before the barrel disintegrates. And you can't, obviously, when you're playing with those forces, you don't want to test how long the barrel's going to go before it explodes. For it to be practical, the US Navy wants 6 rounds a minute sustained for at least 1,000 rounds. So the material science is what's holding it back. If we get a breakthrough in, for example, nanoconstruction or 3D printing, enabling new sort of material composites, then I think it could be deployed pretty quickly. But the US Navy reckons combat testing in 10 years' time, so maybe. Just to go on to the air power question and the dividend for peace idea, I think air power, I would agree that there is this fetishization of air power as being able to deliver all your foreign policy requirements. I actually disagree on the cause. I think the cause isn't the technology. I think the technology is being driven by the requirement, not the other way around. And certainly there's a real tendency to confuse precision with accuracy. You can make a weapon incredibly precise, but if you don't actually specify the right point to hit, the right target to hit, then it's not going to be an accurate strike. That's an intelligence question. But I think the reason we're so good at knocking down regimes is actually because the technology has answered the requirement for that basic feeling that we see. Let's not forget why we went into Libya. It wasn't to try and reconstruct Libya. It was to stop Gaddafi flattening Benghazi with 300,000 civilians in it. Because we could, because we had the capability, and because it was on our doorstep. The reason, again, why people wanted to go into Syria, a lot of people, was because there's a dictator using chlorine gas and massacring his own civilians and has been doing it for a year. There is a Western instinct to, we look at this stuff in the media, it's much more visible than it ever was, say in Cambodia with the Khmer Rouge, no one really saw it at the time. But because of the media, because of, we can see this stuff, there's an instinct to say, well, can we do something about it? Well, yeah, air power means we can flatten most regimes fairly quickly. Well, then we should do it, is the instinct. And also, politicians chase headlines. You know, we have to be able to be seen, we have to be seen to do something. The problem comes in, for me, around the fact that the military is a very bad tool for building a state. I mean, you look at the examples where it's worked, Japan, Germany, post-1945, it wasn't the military that rebuilt the state. It was the civilians living there, with the military providing security and the Marshall Plan providing, food. I think this idea where we've gone wrong is going in without a plan for reconstruction, not necessarily going in to start with. That's whether it's our fight. That's a moral issue rather than I would say a military issue. What I would say is air power means that we can now topple and have proven capable of toppling appalling regimes with an astonishingly low body count in terms of both civilians and actually enemy combatants. The problem is we're then incapable of building a functioning state, so we then have to stay there trying to pacify increasingly warring factions. Most of the atrocities in Iraq were not committed by US troops. They were committed by Shia and Sunni militias. But we were not capable of building a state through the military that would stop that from happening. So I do think there's a danger of looking at the technology as the cause rather than the symptom.
Okay, very interesting. Christopher.
Let me address three of those questions, but just on the last thing about regime change. Regime change is the easy part of it. Nation building is the difficult part of it. The thing is that you can do nation building, but you can't do it under fire. You can only do it when the firing has stopped. I went to a conference a couple of years ago on the American occupation of Japan between 1945 and 1950. Do you know how many American soldiers were attacked or killed during that five-year occupation? Zero. Naught. If you're in a situation like that, you can do nation building pretty successfully. But the moment people start firing at you, I'm afraid all the bets are off. National resolve. It's difficult because we're facing two countries that are very nationalistic. One is China, thanks to the patriotic history courses in school. And my Chinese students are as patriotic as they actually get. It's payback time, to a certain extent, for the miseries inflicted upon them in the 19th century. It's also their natural right to be back where they originally were. In Russia, you have the, unfortunately, very strong inferiority complex of a people who believe that they can never be a great society, but they can once again be a great power. These are the problems that we have to deal with. We can't have patriotic history courses in this country. We don't believe in British exceptionalism as we did in the 19th century. So basically, we will be back to the question of national resolve. The problem here is that we don't trust the politicians, and the politicians don't trust us. When the Chilcot report is finally published, if it's published, I think we may never be back in the war business again because of the incompetence of the political class, and that includes the generals, by the way, not just the politicians. I remember during the debate on Syria, when famously the House of Commons for the first time in 40 years said no to a British Prime Minister, the Sunday Times was outraged for two reasons. One, it was outraged that the House of Commons said no. But secondly, it was outraged at the case that David Cameron put for it. which they wonderfully said was like going before Parliament and asking for the authorization for a drive-by shooting. Because what were you going to do after those cruise missiles had actually been fired? What was Plan B? What was going to be the follow-up? What was the next stage? We didn't have one. In other words, we know that our political class cannot think strategically any longer. But they are also frightened of us. Because for every time Blair had to confront the fact that British citizens were going off to fight the British army in Iraq because he'd invaded Iraq, David Cameron has to confront the fact that because we haven't done anything on Syria very much until quite recently, British citizens were going off to fight. It's a risk trap, as sociologists call it. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. If you intervene, your citizens are going to fight you. If you don't intervene, your citizens are going to fight you. This is the political reality, which is why politicians are scared stiff about mobilizing. In essence, they want this disconnect, this Clausewitzian, as you mentioned, Clausewitz, this Clausewitzian, unClausewitzian disconnect between people and government. The other point I wanted to say was ethics. It is extremely important, but I find it very ironical when the economist can call the Perseus bomb, which sucks up all the oxygen in the neighborhood and asphyxiates you to death, the first humane weapons system. I can find it very ironical when Prospect magazine says that the American counterinsurgency doctrine of 2003 is the first humane counterinsurgency doctrine. It's all very strange that we live in a world in which we need constantly to be humane, but we're not quite certain what that means. Now, there is a codicil to the Geneva Conventions called the Martins Clause, which means you have to kill people nicely. It means that you have to respect dignity, human dignity, when killing someone, and secondly, you must not kill someone against the public conscience. But nowhere is the public conscience actually defined. And I suspect the public conscience in this country would be defined rather differently from the public conscience in China or the public conscience in Russia, let alone half a dozen other countries. This is the thing. If you read a book like War by Seb Younger, he's an embedded journalist who saw a Taliban soldier being disintegrated and vaporized by an Apache helicopter. Literally, there was nothing left. The question he raises is, what's the difference between being vaporized by a drone by a guy 7,000 miles away and being vaporized by an Apache helicopter pilot who you can actually look in the eye, sorry, I know you didn't answer this question, so whatever the ethics question was, who you can look in the eyes as he's killing you. Would you rather be killed by a drone today as you're leaving the Barbican or by an Apache helicopter or a small little quadrocopter, a small little drone with a machine gun on it, which you can actually do now? They have already been designed. Okay, I raise this question not to answer it, but just to get you to think about it, because this is the importance of technology. It has a social history. There are ways in which we look at technology from the crossbow, I think that was your question, rather differently. And finally, why don't we have a budget for peace? Well, I think it's very simple. You can wage war, but you can't wage peace. You can declare war, but you can't declare peace. We fight wars for peace. And the first person to tell us this was Aristotle in the Politics, where he says the only purpose of war is peace. ISIS is fighting for peace. It's called a caliphate. When you have the caliphate, you have eternal peace. America's been fighting to make the world safe for democracy since 1917 on the understanding that democracies don't go to war against each other, therefore you have eternal peace. We are all telling ourselves different stories and different sets of narratives which are more or less believable. Perhaps all of them are unbelievable because they're just a story, a just-so story. The only purpose that people go to war for is peace. But the problem is it's their peace. It's not your peace. It's peace on their terms. And that is why any kind of eternal peace would be one that people would be fighting against, because they would not agree with the definition of it. That's the problem. And that's why that poet, Sidney Keyes, said in 1942, the reason the world is at war is it's not yet ready for peace. We've got to start thinking about these ideas far more profoundly than we do. It's not an either-or, in other words, between war or peace. It never actually has been.
James.
Well, I'm even more interested now that Justin's talked a bit more about the railgun. Was that 6,000 rounds a minute? Or
6 rounds per minute.
I was going to say that was a bit quick. 6 rounds a minute. I think it's very interesting to ask, going to Vanessa's point about sort of our ambivalence about war, are those rail guns truly green? I mean, is the megawatts that's powering all this streamlined tungsten, Is it done by a low-carbon source like nuclear or wind power, or is it fossil fuel-based? Now, you can laugh, but I can tell you that before the Volkswagen dispute, the German army was very keen to say that it's a very green army because, you know, while they're shooting you up at the front of the tank, they got a nice green exhaust at the back, you know. And you've got to laugh because it goes exactly to your point. You know, do they feel good about war? Do they feel good about themselves? And they don't. And that, for me, is the key thing. Now, Chris Woods, you know, I know the media and the Bureau of Investigative Journalism and the media narrative and the Cameron narrative in, where was it now? The House of Commons, that's it. You know, is all about drones. But I don't have to accept that narrative, right? And I can remember when we had Star Wars and lasers and all of that, it was all about that. Now, during that era, we in the Revolutionary Communist Party pointed out that what Mary Kaldor, who we were going to invite, but then we realized that Chris was also from LSE, so we couldn't have a public spat. Mary Kaldor maintained that, you know, we don't want nuclear weapons. They're all baroque. They're over the top. What we need is precision-guided munitions. Precision-guided munition turned out to be cruise, which is what, Putin is sending in from the Caspian, I believe, or the Black Sea. My geography is not that great, but Caspian. So, you know, what's new in show business? You use anything that you can, and then a number of liberals will rush in and say, you know, is this really humane and all the rest of it? We've had some good jokes about that. You know, forget it. It's never going to be humane. They're going to use everything that they can get. And the problem that they've got is not just that ISIL will, British people will go and join ISIL whether or not we intervene. It's that the population in general, the general population is no longer so motivated by nationalism as it was in the past. And in this respect, therefore, if they lack the popular support for war, then they are going to be driven in this dehumanized drone direction. But that's just a moment in the developing technological armor arsenal that they have. I think, you know, the budget for peace question, I'm sure it wasn't your intent, but I'm hearing it as an intent from here, is that we don't want to smash up Libya in the future. You know, we need a budget for peace for post the smashing up. I'm sure that's not what you were saying. Great. But I want to say that, and it is what you were saying, Justin, a bit. And why would we be good at making the peace any more than we are at conducting a humane war? Right? Why would that follow? You know, you throw in induction, you throw a little pair of glasses up and down for 20 times, and it always produces a bad result. They break. That's what we've done in the Middle East. So why would we be good at getting the second part of it right? When, in fact, the whole purpose of war now is what I would call, I have called in a review on Clausewitz, precautionary war, which shows the commonality with the green point of view. You want to take precautions, so you smash up Libya. You don't think beyond that. If they did, you can be sure that Libya would be even more warlike than it is at the moment. And in this respect, I can't accept, Justin, that the main casualties in Iraq have been to do with Sunni and Shia militias. You don't have to go into the, you know, Amnesty International numbers game on bombing and casualties to know that something like 100,000 Iraqis died at the hands, maybe more, right? Maybe 500,000 are displaced and everything, at the hands of air power, Western air power. So it's just not true to say that these militias, while they've been bloody and awful, you know, let's not take the emphasis away from the West's responsibility. And the real way to have a budget for peace is not a financial question. It's to mobilize more people on an unconditional hostility to any more interference in the Middle East, which will only be a preface, already is the preface, to great power conflict.
There are stirrings on the left-hand side of the panel. I want to respond to this calumny that you're...
I just wanted to jump in on that Iraq question. It depends where you jump in on the Iraq conflict. So between 2003 and 2006, before the Civil War began, US-British forces primarily responsible for civilian fatalities in Iraq. Absolutely no doubt. Where things get complicated is the Civil War that's provoked by al-Qaeda in Iraq. And at that point, which is coupled with the surge where the Americans actually start paying a heavy blood price to protect Sunnis in Iraq, then you have catastrophic casualties among Iraqis primarily because of the war that breaks out between Sunni and Shia. So I think you're right and you're wrong. You can characterize it up to 2006, but once that civil war kicked in, we were basically bystanders in Iraqi horror, which we had enabled, by the way.
Well, then we're not bystanders.
Well, we were unable to stop that war. And in fact, for Iraqis, by the way, when you talk to Iraqis, when they look at the horrors of the 2000s, it's 2006 onwards that is their nightmare. I mean, the invasion was bad enough, but the civil war was catastrophic. So, I mean, we enabled and facilitated that, but we didn't cause those casualties. That's what I'd say.
Okay, right. Well, we'll let you come back to that. Let's have some more discussion from the floor. So,
you talk about civilians and how we can't hurt them, we can't kill them. But what do you define a civilian in a war? In a war, surely the whole country, in a way, becomes the enemy. And in that way, it's a very humane war if you kill them. You talk about how war is now meant to be fought humanely and how it's all very nice and these air things make it impersonal. But in a way, according to reports, lots of drone pilots have to get psychiatric care and really struggle. So it's not impersonal at all, and it's still very inhumane for them because they're going to kill hundreds of people, and they know they're killing hundreds of people. It's killing them. And my second point is you talk about the Iraqi war a lot and the Syria, but if we go back to Vietnam and we go back to these older wars where we had troops on the ground, yes, they didn't work out. They went very badly, but at least we were putting force in the troop. We knew what was going on the ground, whilst now we've got this thing at the air, which is telling us, yes, everything that's going on, but we don't see what the people are saying. We don't see what actually is going on. We don't understand that the Syrians may not actually like anyone. We don't actually know anything, really. We just know what we want to know.
I've got two questions. One, quite specific, which leads to a more general one. Picking up on Justin's point about the importance of the electromagnetic spectrum, if I wanted to disrupt a country locally or preferably nationally, I think, try to interfere with the electromagnetic spectrum. If I could take out the electromagnetic spectrum, cause a huge spike over London, take out all the computer systems, disrupt all the civil effects and so on, potentially causing economic chaos and so on and so forth, I could hopefully do that quite cheaply at very little cost to myself, but with huge impact on my target. And my specific question is, it's not been, you know, that sort of electromagnetic warfare hasn't really been mentioned by the panel, and I don't know about that. Could somebody tell me what the potentialities are and the threat potentials are of that at the moment? Which leads to the sort of more general question that if that is a realistic scenario, are we moving to a situation, a kind of tipping away from the historical superpower model of warfare where the greater power you can expend, the greater military power you have, the more likely your prospects of success, to a place where very small groups, terrorist groups for instance, can make huge impacts to which those superpowers are highly vulnerable?
If you remember Ocean's 11, you'll know that in fact it's entirely practical to just steal an experimental device and take out various blocks of Las Vegas for 30 seconds. So it's there, that's the term. It wasn't an embarrassing plot device, that was real. Move forward, so this guy and then the guy with the check shirt in front of you.
Hello, this is a bit related to what James was saying about hearts and minds and also what Chris has said about some potential conflict with China. I almost know nothing about China, but say compared to the Cold War, which was an actual war, I guess, where there was a ideological either thrust or some kind of justification you'd imagine within the Soviet Union. With China, I just see it as being a very technocratic almost. It might be labeled communist, but it seems to be run by managers and engineers and things like this. So I just wondered if anyone's got any idea of any kind of ideological coherence that would allow China to actually operate in some extended war. I mean, are we talking up its danger, I guess?
Hi. Earlier on, you were saying that it's going to be a war against China, which is patriotic, and Russia, which is patriotic. But don't you think also the US is also very patriotic, like with the swearing allegiance to a flag and stuff? So don't you think it will be even worse because there's three very patriotic superpowers? And also, do you think war has like lost its chivalrousness? Because in video games, all video games are based on either medieval warfare or like you play as a person. You're never a cubicle warrior, really, because that's not glamorous. And that people maybe like don't really like all this drone stuff because it's not cool.
Okay, that's true. Yes, just across the aisle. Yeah. Thank you.
Picking up on the point raised earlier of how you define a civilian, I was wondering kind of how you define war. You mentioned in your first thing that there's 55 days between America and China before they kind of almost realise they're at war. Historically, we think of a war being the Second World War. It's my grave duty to tell you we are now at war with Germany. Are we at war with Syria at the moment? We're certainly carrying out military action there. Has technology changed what the definition of war is, and will wars be declared in the same way in future?
I just wondered, when people talking about air power and the use of drones, whether that was actually what the panel thought to the idea that that was taking place because there was, if there was no public commitment to a particular war taking place, there was therefore no acceptance of infantry deaths or soldier deaths within the country, and therefore people were resorting to hands-off warfare on that basis. I also wondered, it was mentioned that a sort of civil war in Iraq broke out kind of while there were coalition troops in the country, and I just wondered why the panel thought that had sort of happened and why the coalition hadn't been able to stop that happening.
The impression the panel, many of the panel feel we might just sit on our hands, continue sitting on our hands, reference Syria and Iraq. But bearing in mind now we have a massive population movement, which to my mind is threatening to destabilize the political will in the European Union, is it really a practical proposition to sit on our hands and do nothing at all? What would you advise Mr. Cameron to do in the next few months?
Yeah, a comment and a question. My comment, I might be a little bit unfair here because I came in a little late this morning. Just on some of the comments on the panel, there seems to be a slight disconnect between some of the discussion of Western-led interventions and the kind of the peace, the nation-building, the aftermath. I mean, I think... the gentleman on my far right here, you're right when you say, yes, when we look at Iraq and the civil war, we can't really disconnect that from the initial period of Western intervention and bombing and the destruction of Saddam Hussein's regime. I mean, which I disagree with, but obviously the civil war would have not happened to the same extent if the initial intervention hadn't happened. So I think we need to avoid that disconnect. I mean, similarly with Japan. I mean, I'm not surprised the Japanese didn't attack Americans after the droppings of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the occupation. So I think we need more of a connect between the kind of initial periods of interventions and the second ones, and the second period. A question. Why do you think there seemed to be such an overreaction to the Russian cruise missile launches against ISIL? I mean, I think it's a negative development, but is it to do with the technology? Obviously, there's a long tradition of cruise missiles being something different. Is it to do with who did it, the Russians? I mean, compared with the American bombing of a hospital in Afghanistan recently, or French bombings in the Middle East, they didn't seem to get the same treatment. Or is it to do with the fact that kind of maybe Putin seems to have a bit more bravado, maybe has a bit of an ideology, you know, I'm kind of leading the Christian world against ISIS and the Americans aren't really up to it. So is it to do with the fact that You know, he's got the bravado, and even though it's a bit of a kind of tin pot idea, at least he has a tin pot idea. And, you know, maybe Obama doesn't even seem to have a tin pot idea when it comes to war. So what's it about? Why that overreaction to the cruise missile launches by Russia?
Thanks very much. You've all given really interesting, eloquent discussions on the topic. But I've got to admit, I'm quite confused. It's left me much more confused than when I started. For example, on three main points. Number one, we now know more of what's going on in the world than we ever have at any point in history. And yet we don't know what is actually being done by these drones and what's actually happening on the ground. Despite the fact that every US military person has a mobile phone and is calling back to Texas, telling his wife what's happening minute by minute during the battle, for example. The second point is morality. We're too moral to blind troops, and yet we're happy to kill people remotely. The third point is with respect to who's running this show. We've had stated that the politicians are not capable of making trustworthy, valid decisions. The military leaders are theoretically following the politicians' guidance. And I'm sure they're certainly not having intellectual discussions such as what we're having today. Equally, I can see that things are not happening that are the will of the people in any of these countries that are involved. So I'm wondering, is it the companies that are making the technology that are having a guiding force in how things are progressing? Or who is running things? So.
Okay, thank you. Okay, there's actually, in terms of what's going on the ground, which is a very, very interesting question, the third session in this strand is called The Blog of War. It is about how you report on war, you know, in the circumstances that we have today. So I'm sure that will come up again there. All right, so I'm going to bring the panel back in to sum up. You've got about 4 minutes each maximum, maybe 3.5. But I'll wave at you if you're going on. I'm going to start from the right this time. I'm going to let James get his retaliation in first. James, your final comments and answers.
I'm delighted that the discussion has turned away from particular technologies, which I think transfix us far too easily, into the question that you've raised, sir, about, you know, winning the peace and all of that. And I want to say that you know, the diplomacy and Richard Cobden and the view that liberal internationalism and the United Nations is an alternative to war misses the intrinsic connection, which was pointed to at the back there, between war and peace. It's another form of war, diplomacy. Just as making the peace or nation building and sort of being a bystander in the Shia-Sunni conflict is another form of war. Nobody can persuade me that the US Air Force, General Petraeus, and all of these folks, I may have my dates wrong, were not responsible for the internecine warfare between tribes, religions, and everything else that went on in Iraq, right? The responsibility lies with the West. And this is my answer to you, sir. You would like to perhaps caricature my kind of anti-militarism as sitting on hands and not being responsible. That is the, if not from you, that's the classic way in which people say, look, you know, if we don't do something, we must do something. We must do something. And the doing something has led, with the possible exception, which I'm happy to debate with Chris Coker and anybody else, of Bosnia, all of the results so far have been negative. They have all fallen down to ground like that. And so I'm not asking for you to keep your sit on your hands. I'm asking for you to join with me in an anti-war movement that also has no illusions in the United Nations, no illusions in humane killings, blinding, not murdering, and all of that stuff, and identifies the Russian threat in Syria as negative, but identifies the main enemy being at home. It's our own bourgeoisie, a classical Marxist position. I see no reason to change it after 45 years. The classical Marxist position is that it's the Camerons and the Corbyns and the no to Trident but yes to everything else people who are the main danger to peace or any kind of budget for peace, you know, right now. All of their interventions have been negative. Look, they can't even organise a National Health Service hospital, so why the fuck are they going to organise Iraq, excuse my language? But I get angry about that, and I think the anger that you express, madam, is entirely right. You know, they are immoral, amoral, and they will use us as cannon fodder very easily. And at the same time, you rightly make the point, you know, and somebody else made the point, are we at war in Syria? The answer is we are at war, but we don't know much about it, right? And that is the problem that we face. Until we use all the expertise on this panel to make a coherent anti-war case, they're going to go on getting away with it.
Okay, thank you. Christopher.
Very quick one on Japan. It wasn't the atomic bomb which explains why the United States didn't have an insurgency to deal with in Japan. It was because they kept the emperor in power. In other words, they avoided the ultimate humiliation, which would not have been acceptable. Most people didn't know about the atomic bomb until considerably later. In fact, there was even a Miss Atomic Bomb pageant in the United States for a couple of years, and 101 companies adopted the mushroom cloud as their logo. That's how popular atomic weapons were then. Does that leave me with 40? That's 40 seconds gone. There is a new concept in the ethics of war about the damage done to drone pilots because they have to see what they do, and often because they have to look at the people that they're killing for a day or 2 days and sometimes more, which is very unusual in war. The only people who've been called upon to do that have been snipers in the past, and snipers have always had the great gift of not pressing the trigger if they didn't want to. Unfortunately, a drone pilot is in a chain of command. Drone pilots have to do what they are ordered to do, and that is why PTSD is so high. That is why in the US Air Force, number of people actually volunteering to become drone pilots is going down very considerably. It's a matter of great concern. That's why, by the way, everyone is so conflicted. American soldiers read zombie books and love zombie movies because, you see, with zombies, there are no ethical issues at all. There are no Guantanamo Bays for zombies. There are no Abu Ghraibs for zombies. There are no NGOs for zombies, zombies without frontiers and things of this kind. You just shoot. It's the ultimately morally unchallenging war. And that's why these young people, the cadets at West Point, I can tell you, love the zombies. For that reason. Now, third point I make. How long have we got?
About 50 seconds.
50 seconds. U.S. patriotism. Yes, well, only 0.1% of the American people are willing to serve in the military. But remember, 73% are disbarred, either because they have criminal records or because they're overweight. That doesn't actually stop people who've been playing Call of Duty for a long time going out. In fact, there's called a reverse jihad in the United States. Evangelical Christians are now joining up to go off and fight the nasty people out in the Middle East. Biker gangs in Denmark have gone to join the Kurds in fighting the nasty people. There are still people willing to do this, but they're not always in uniform. Last point about China. If you look at the books that are now being written on how a war between China and the United States will pan out, the whole thing is that it's largely in cyberspace. It's about putting the viruses in someone's system where they remain dormant for a very long time and undetected, and where they only go critical on day one, when often, for you, it's too late. So the big, and I shall end on this one, there's the last Pentagon war game done in a war against China. They found that the Chinese had put so many viruses in the American aircraft carrier system that you could no longer launch the planes by computer. You had to do so by hand on the deck, as they did at the Battle of Midway in 1942. This is what keeps people awake at night, I can assure you.
Okay, thank you very much. Justin.
sorry, quite a lot to try and answer and sum up, but... I'd start with on the point on civilians. if you're fighting a war against even a nation state, civilians are still civilians. There's very, very clear Geneva Convention on that. If you are armed and you are party to the conflict, then you are a combatant. Otherwise, you're a civilian. And by the way, it is simply not true to say that it is illegal to kill civilians. In fact, it is legal through the Geneva Convention to kill civilians as long as it is proportionate to the military effect achieved, and you do all you can to reduce civilian casualties to a minimum. That's nothing to do with morality. It's just a point to say that that is actually in the Geneva Convention. It is legal to kill civilians as long as it's proportionate. In terms of knowing things about our targets, it's worth pointing out that the reasons why we are currently so fond of air-only campaigns is because the last two major wars we fought in Iraq and Afghanistan involved a lot of our men on the ground, and not just losing limbs, but coming back extremely traumatized. We actually spent far more energy in Helmand, for example, in understanding the population than in killing anyone. In fact, courageous restraint cost a lot of lives of the Brits. The interesting thing being that when we, for example, had to give over the Kajaki Dam area to the US Marine Corps because going in with a few paras and then basically being besieged by people who saw this as an easy win to kill the Brits because they didn't have enough led to things getting much worse. We had to hand over to the US Marine Corps, who did not use courageous restraint, as we would call it, called in loads of airstrikes, lots of indirect fire, and the response from the local population is, thank goodness, these guys are fighting the Taliban. You guys were in league with them because, well, we knew where they were, and with all your magic technology, you must know where they were, and you just didn't go out and fight them. Interesting change in morality there. And final thing I'd say is on the EM spectrum stuff, very interesting to see the coordination center for the National Air Traffic Service going down for about 40 minutes a couple of months ago. That system, it was called a power cut. The power failed. That system has triple redundant generator backup systems for precisely the reason that even if the entire country has a blackout, the National Air Traffic System must not fail. The only conceivable explanation I can see for that is someone got into the system and shut it down and then allowed it to come back up again quickly. Now, that to me is also connected to the fact that it was at the same week of the Minsk II agreements and the same time when Russian nuclear bombers buzzed not just the western side but the eastern side of our airspace. That is a state threat saying, this is the potential for a mass casualty event in your critical infrastructure, but we're not going to cause a mass casualty event. Oh, it's interesting. Dangerous world, you know.
Okay. Thank you. And finally, Chris.
Just to jump in on that question of civilians and how you define a civilian, I would disagree with Justin. A civilian is no longer a civilian. I mean, this is the complexity of the kind of wars we're fighting at the moment. There was the International Committee for the Red Cross issued guidance notes in 2009 where they created the concept of a civilian combatant. And that's what drives much of our military thinking now. The Geneva Conventions were drawn up to deal with nation versus nation wars. Well, they're not the wars we fight anymore. Somebody asked, are we fighting a war with Syria? No, we're fighting a war on Syria right now. And this is part of the way that we're fighting wars. We tend to engage non-state actors on particular territories, and they are civilian combatants. A member of a militia, a member of a group like ISIL, Daesh, is defined as a civilian in law, but they're also a combatant. And this gets really complicated. Somebody else asked about the massive population movements from Syria and is it practical not to do something? Well, just to be absolutely clear, the people of Syria are fleeing bombs. Our bombs, their bombs, Russia's bombs. It doesn't really matter to the civilians on the ground in right now whose bombs. And as I said, we have dropped tens of thousands ourselves. That's what they're fleeing. And if we're going to talk about solutions for Syria, my personal view is the solution is not a military one. We cannot resolve this militarily. There was a question about the overreaction to Russia's cruise missiles. It's interesting for me because we've talked about precision and new warfare here. Cruise missiles are yesterday's kind of great technological breakthrough. In fact, they're really generally devastating in terms of impact cruise missiles. They're not particularly accurate. And they tend to carry huge amounts of ordnance on them for effect. And yes, there was a strong reaction when Russia used cruise missiles. But here's where things get a bit dangerous for all of us. Almost exactly a year before Russia used its cruise missiles in Syria, on its first night of the air war in Syria, the United States launched cruise missiles, hit a town called Kafr Darian, and killed, I think, 15 civilians. We know all of their names. We've got pictures of them. We know exactly what happened. The United States has yet to admit to a single one of those deaths, but it got on the TV pretty damn quickly when the Russians used their cruise missiles and accused the Russians of inaccuracy. Everybody's using their weapons pretty badly at the moment. That's the issue.
Okay, can we thank our panel? I thought it was a really interesting debate. Thank you.